My name is Erica Nelson, and we are in Lucas, Kansas, at the home base of the world's largest collection of the world's smallest versions of the world's largest things. It is the world's biggest collection. Not certified by Guinness, but it's all right. I can hold my own. It's been a decade now, which is amazing to me that I've done anything for 10 years in a row. Spent the last 10 years traveling the country, seeking out roadside attractions that bill themselves as a world's largest thing. I go and photograph that thing, gather its background story, find out why a community or an individual might have built such a world's largest thing. Then I make a world's smallest version of that world's largest thing, add it to the collection, and that's how you get the world's largest collection of the world's smallest versions of the world's largest things. Simple. Why would I do such a thing? I love gathering stories of people who've done something unique or different or added to their community in some way. And I've always been drawn to roadside attractions. I was that little girl in the back seat screaming for us to stop at the giant 8-ball water tower, and didn't always get to stop there. And when I started getting to direct my own path, I was drawn back to these things that spoke to me of road trips, spoke to me of small towns, and it just started filling my life. I started doing the replicas when I was teaching at the University of Kansas, and to keep myself sane during that sort of grad school master's thesis work and teaching, I would sometimes just need a break. So this was always my sort of release, my wandering, my exploration, and it just started growing from there. And shrinking and growing at the same time. The point of the collection is partially an artwork, but more to retell the stories of these communities that are building their big things. So I use it as an excuse to retell community stories. And so when people view the collection, they bring me stories of their own too, of road trips that they remember or monuments that they really fell in love with. So I really use it as a way to connect with people on this sort of common theme and sort of reinvent that sense of wonder that we all had when we were the girl in the back of the gremlin shouting to stop, reminding people that they have their own destiny, that they can stop and celebrate the things that are really unique and special along our American byways. I describe Lucas as Norman Rockwell meets Northern Exposure with a little bit of Twin Peaks thrown in. It is all those idealized great versions of a small town with this cornerstone of an amazing environment that means that everybody grew up with art and nobody knows that it's odd or different or unique. It's just a part of your life and a part of your community. So early on, I sold everything that I owned and moved into a vehicle and lived on the road for a period of 2 years, exploring roadside attractions and small towns that had integrated arts communities. And that's what brought me to Lucas. And I had no intention of living here. I was just passing through. But while I was here for about a month volunteering out at the Grassroots Arts Center, I went to an auction and there's a house that sold for $1,000. I couldn't even wrap my head around it. This was a house that sold for $1,000. And that was a very unique example. Not all of them do. But it started me thinking of, if I ever were to settle down, where would I go? And I looked around town, and the house right next to this iconic Garden of Eden site was for sale. I couldn't stop thinking about it, so as I headed south for the winter and ended up purchasing it over the phone for less than the price of a used car, and I didn't expect this to be a home. I expected it to be a home base, but the more that I interacted with the community and saw how open and inviting they were, the more I realized that this actually is a home. And that is not what you can say about a lot of small towns. They never made me feel like a stranger. And the local meat guy, who is, I think, fourth generation Czechoslovakian, accidentally called me a local in front of tourists one day. And I waited for the tourist to leave. I was sitting in the window of the meat market. And as the tourist left, I looked down and he said, "I gotcha." He's like, "What? You called me a local." So it was a crowning achievement. Yeah. I have no relatives in the cemetery, but local nonetheless. piece is, some people use it as a loaded word. Like, they're expecting you to come to the word from the same place that they are. But to me, my first reaction when I hear the word or think about the concept of peace, it means getting along. It means being able to compromise and see two or three different viewpoints and being okay with it. Not going at a conversation or an existence in trying to change somebody else, but being able to have an open flow of communication. So I guess it's just, for me, a breaking down of barriers that end up bringing us apart. It's so communications that can bring us together. And that, to me, is what, when we say we're working towards peace, it seems like that can be a parallel to we're working towards better understanding of each other and being able to exist with a bunch of different viewpoints and a bunch of different opinions and be okay with it. I've tried to work towards that sort of open set of communications or peace with each other in figuring out what pisses me off, because it's usually that same sort of lack of communication, and being really, really self-aware of when I'm becoming irritated or feel myself closing up, what am I putting up a barrier towards? So it starts out with identification of what is creating a barrier in me and trying to understand how some things I say or do might create that same sort of barrier in somebody else. Or in finding a situation where you just really can't seem to work it through without getting that nasty feeling in your gut of, oh, I dread this. I don't even want to talk to this person. Oh. Figuring out what that key point is and a way to work around it. Sadly, sometimes that does mean avoiding things of, oh, this person just makes me so angry and I'm not sure why. Maybe you just need to avoid that person for a while until you do know how to work it out. Or if you can argue in a good way together and both work through that sort of point of conflict. Those are the things that I've been trying to do to create a more peaceful existence, even just for myself. And hopefully that spreads a ripple in creating a better atmosphere just all the way around. Life in a small town can create its own challenges in that you don't get to pick and choose who you associate with, or if you do need a break, or you realize, you know, it's really hard to work with this person or this set of people, you can't just not do it. You still have to get together as a community to produce something or get something done. And I think that's one of the great things about the size of Lucas. It's 400 people. So it's really important to everybody involved that you do things even if you don't always get along, or be able to say up front, you know what, I can't work with that person right now. Maybe on the next project, we'll be at a different space. One of the advantages of being an outsider coming in, even though I did get called a local at some point, is that you can be a little bit of Switzerland, because you don't have that blood relation to anybody in the community. There were no schoolmates, no school chums. I don't know the rivalries, or I didn't know when I got here. So I had this really advantageous space of being Switzerland. It gets harder and harder to retain that the longer you are in a place. And that can be said for any neighborhood too, or any country. Switzerland's still Switzerland. But you can use that sort of non-blood card to say, you know what, I don't know what your rivalry is, so why don't we just do this anyway? We keep coming back to Lucas being really, really unique in that it's a small town that has embraced some really offbeat, odd, quirky, alternative use of material things. If you have a work ethic, it doesn't matter whether or not they understand what you're doing, they understand that you care about doing it, and they'll support you. That being said, even in town, not everybody likes everybody's pieces of artwork that go on here. They might like Pilar's better than Eric's, or Eric's better than mine, or mine better than somebody else's. So it's still individual taste, but we all work really hard at doing it. they're also not ashamed to ask questions. It's an alternative lifestyle too. Being a project-based person, I'll take a job that takes 2 or 3 months, which means I'm gone. I'm working 14-hour days somewhere else to do one thing, and then I'm back, and I might not be working on a project for a month and a half or 2 months at a time. If you apply that to a very traditional 9-to-5 rural town, that takes some getting used to. But they ask questions about, oh, how does this work? Eric was a booth artist, and I'm not saying that in a negative way at all. He was really good at it, and we talked about this a lot. He goes to fairs and festivals, sets up a booth, sells his wares for 3 to 5 days, and is really great at establishing those worldwide relationships. So seeing an arts industry overlaid on a rural town, people started asking us how our lives work too, and realizing that he was really good at his chosen set of jobs in the art world, and I am good at the chosen set of jobs in my art world too. And when you started equating it to farming, you make hay while the sun shines. It's project based. It's just they didn't think about it the same way that arts as an industry, the same way that they thought about their own jobs. And I think just in us being so open and people asking questions and us answering them, and vice versa, how does the combine work, and how much work does it take to get that to operate for 1 week out of the year? It's like, well, that's kind of like the kiln I just bought. It was this much. I use it maybe 6 hours out of a month, but it's an important part of how I do my job, how I do my business. So I think they equate art with work here. And in a rural community, that does matter a lot. Part of what makes Lucas Lucas is this sort of continuing timeline of creativity. So there's always been an honor of these real people doing real things out of the materials that they had at hand. And that's continued on today. Eric Abraham moved to town, I think a year after I did, and created a ceramic studio downtown in the old Chevy dealership. So while he was redoing the building, people who'd gotten used to stopping in and chatting at the Chevy shop would still come in and chat while Eric was building his environment. So again, it wasn't anything odd, or it was odd and unusual, but it wasn't odd or unusual for people to feel welcome into that process. I moved into town, drawn by the Garden of Eden, and then started working on my own house 10 years ago. And one of the first things I did when I got the house was there were a whole bunch of chairs left here that I didn't really need, didn't know what to do with them. So there's one tree in the backyard, so I put them all up the tree just to get them out of the way, but not have them just laying around. And my neighbor comes across the street and he's like, well, I know your name, not sure what you're doing. Looks like you're putting chairs in your tree. He's like, yes, I am. Okay, do you need a ladder? You want some help? So that's the sort of thing that has always happened with the arts in Lucas. It's just people doing stuff and supporting each other doing it. The cherry tree is the tree with the chairs in it. Turned out to be the cherry tree. I think peace starts from within. And you have to be at peace with yourself, or at least recognizing what those obstacles are for you to attain any sort of peace with the way that you are interacting with other people. To me, one of the obstacles ends up being probably a normal human thing, or a normal thing for artists, is that I often feel misunderstood. People don't know what my motivations are, even though I think they're really, really clear. And so that sometimes ends up being a stumbling block that I don't always realize is there, or thinking that everybody comes from the same background and would understand the same either references or motivations, and then running into that block and thinking, oh yeah, you're a completely different person with a completely different background, and I need to take that into account whenever I'm doing my thing and creating conflict that I didn't know I was creating. So I think some of the obstacles are assuming that somebody else comes from the same place that you do. Not recognizing in yourself when you're creating conflict. like being that bull in the china shop, which again, I tend to do. If somebody isn't as talkative as I am, I can steamroll them. And vice versa, if somebody is a storyteller, a talker, and that's the way they communicate, but I'm wanting some other sort of communication, I'll think, oh, you're just blowing me off, so I won't communicate with them in the same way, not realizing that that's how they communicate. It's more like a sharing of parables, and they lead up to something, and I'm not always patient enough to let that unfold, or patient enough to let some of the quieter people in my life have a room for a voice. So I think a lot of that can translate into the bigger picture too of, are you letting all those voices have the room that they need to be able to say what they need to say? And I don't know if it's specific to artists or creative types only. I'm sure everybody has this in their own realm, but I think because in being a visual artist, putting things together, sometimes in that creative process, you really just want to play without having any sort of rules or restrictions or even thinking about why you're playing the way that you are or why you're exploring something that the way that you are. And when somebody comes into the middle of that process who doesn't understand the creative process or might not understand why you are putting chairs up in your tree, it could be really easy for their initial reaction to be, well, that's stupid. What are you doing that for? Where you're in the middle of it and you don't know why, but you know that for some reason this seems really important for you to do and you just want to do it and see what turns out. So getting a critique in the middle of a process from even fellow creative types sometimes ends up being that stopping point. Or you start thinking too much about how is this going to be received as opposed to just following through with a process that you know is important to you to fulfill. But I can sometimes stop myself because I think too much about, oh, but what if somebody sees me putting things up in my tree? What am I going to say if somebody asks me why I'm doing it? As opposed to just doing it. So I think that misunderstanding of somebody else's creative process can be a stopper too. If somebody works in a much quieter way and they just need 3 weeks with nothing else to do and everybody to leave them alone, but you don't know that and you decide, oh, I haven't seen him in a while, I should go bring him some cookies. I'll go knock on the door at 2 p.m. and see what's going on. Maybe I should just sit down and chat for a while. And you're really interrupting that creative process, but you don't know that. That can be a barrier to how different people work. I've gotten better about being able to tell people, you know what, this is not a talking day for me. I need to just work on some stuff. But I'm not always as good as I should be about it. So I was thinking, sometimes there are don't bug me days too, that I really should have a red flag that I just kind of hang out at the front door, that it's just one of those, this is the warning flag, this is a good time to just leave the Erica alone, let her do whatever it is she's doing without interruption. But I don't know how that would actually be received. Oh, so I'm letting that preconceived notion of somebody else's opinion already stop me from doing a red flag day. Ah, I already did it. One of my favorite projects to do every year is an installation at the Smoky Hill River Festival, and they hire installation artists to just come and create something within a space. And it happens in a park. I did the same kind of thing 2 or 3 years in a row in the same kind of space using these plastic inserts that you stick into a chain link fence. And the first year, it was one of my first years at the festival, had no idea where it was or why it was going on or who I'd be interacting with. So I came early because I was paranoid about the deadline. And there's nobody else in the park except for this homeless guy who lives there. And he's kind of the caretaker of the park. And as we've started to know each other better, I see what an amazing important part he is to the Salina community. And most people recognize that too. Everybody knows Bill. But my first interaction with him was putting these plastic inserts in the chain link fence. And he would chat with me while I was doing it. I would ask him questions about the park. And we just started developing this friendship. And second year, he wanted to help. So this is a 70-year-old man up on a ladder helping me put in cups and had some great interactions. The park guys were all coming around making sure that I was treating Bill with respect. And it's going to make me cry a little bit. Whenever we'd take a break, we'd go and they'd serve lunch to the artists. But they made sure that it was only the artists. And as we went by, the park guys came up and went to the lunch line first and went through the line and said, made sure to say, Bill isn't just the caretaker of this park. He's an artist. He's been working on that installation all day. And if anybody says anything at all about Erica and her friend coming through this line, you're going to be, you find it really difficult to do the rest of your project. So he had this sort of front team of making sure that he was treated with respect. And the only angry thing I heard was from the service people later who brought in the food and they said, why did they think we'd not let him in? I was like, oh man. They wanted to stop a problem before it started, which might or might not have been a problem, but it was such a great mix of people wanting to do the right thing and maybe overstepping some bounds and maybe making too big of a deal for something that was human nature and would have come out anyway. So it was a good sort of struggle to piece through some awkward communications. And sorry I can't say that without getting teary, but Bill means a lot to me. I think I was at a park when you asked about it. And I remember thinking at that minute, just even looking around me, what peace would mean to just somebody passing by if I just blurted out the question, what sort of responses I would get. And I didn't actually do it. I didn't actually ask anybody. And I think part of that is being afraid of the commitment to the deeper conversation when sometimes you want to be passing through. So I don't know that we always give the space for the conversation to happen because it is a big investment. I think you have to approach things in a hopeful manner. I don't think you could continue if you weren't. But actually, I take that back because I also have this one theory of mean people. People who are so full of negative energy and they're always going to be the naysayer. And I think also the people who strive in their life to create conflict. I think they are an incredibly necessary part of the process. So you need those people who are so full of doom and despair and hopelessness that they consolidate it all into one specific person so you know where it is. And you can sort of mark it and identify as like, that takes all of that energy out of somebody else. We all know that you're going to be the curmudgeon. You have a usefulness too because it makes me stronger in my convictions and I'm never going to convince you to be different, but I do know how you're operating and thank you for consolidating all that bundle of hate into one spot that I can avoid. I think one of the bits of wisdom that I picked up from on the road is to let the story happen, is to let people tell theirs. And a lot of times it's much more important to listen instead of being the one telling the story. It seems like it's a universal question. I think that's what we do as human beings, is search for the answer to why we're here and how can we get along with people a little bit better and make our own lives easier while we're here, but also have a positive influence. The ideas could come from the way that I was brought up in a pretty community atmosphere. But at the same time, I spend a lot of time alone on the road. But those alone points are connected by meeting a bunch of people on the way in sort of big groups, lots of alone time, big groups, lots of alone time. So you get this sort of overstimulation and then lots of solitude to sort of piece all this stuff together. So I find myself thinking about things like that on the road an awful lot. I think just in that continual quest to figure out why we do what we do. And I don't expect there to ever be an answer, just as I don't know if there's an answer to how would you achieve peace in your life. I think it's part of the journey and the process. I think that's also where a lot of the questions come from, but also the thoughts and ideas about those questions come from.